These are facts. But facts fail to paint the full picture of what it is like to live in or to visit Wichita.
And welcome back to another episode of the Wichita Podcast. This is your good friend David. I am once again on site for another Wichita Talks series episode. We'll get into that here in a second. But now that we've been here for 14 seconds, I'm going to talk to you guys about Central Market Wine and Spirits. As you guys know, Central Market Wine and Spirits is the primo place to shop real local, to get your real yummy alcohols, liqueurs, wines, beers, all of the great things over on the corner of Central and Oliver. Tell them the Wichita Podcast sent you. Shop around, partake responsibly, and have a good time. We love our Central Market Wine and Spirits. We need to get over there to do another live podcast here soon. I'm sure we can probably set that up. But yeah, Central Market Wine and Spirits in the corner of Central and Oliver. Tell them the Wichita Podcast sent you. Well, everyone, I am, as you probably have noticed in the title of the episode, at a fun place here in the Wichita area with a good friend of mine, one of my best friends, Matt Fouts. How you doing, Matt?
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're absolutely welcome. And I maybe took some liberties in discussing our friendship, but I do appreciate you being here nonetheless. We are here to talk a little bit about Tanganyika today. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Tanganyika. I got Tangawaka, Tanganyika. Like, it's all over the board.
What's your favorite thing you've heard it?
Tangawaka. Tangawaka. Like, yeah, I don't know where you get a W
right,
in it, but
right.
It just is like, all right.
Well, thanks for joining me. Tell me, what is your current position here at Tanganyika and your relationship with Wichita a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm currently, my external title is director. Internally, my role is visionary. So okay. My little email signature says visionary/director. I've been with the park since it opened. Of course, it's owned by my family. So I've
right.
Really been here my whole life.
Right.
But we didn't officially work at the park until we decided to open up as a wildlife park. So at that point, I came on as the assistant director. My dad being the director, and just help build the guest experience and shape what the park looks like to date. And then now in my new role, I get to kind of set the future and what we plan and hope to be.
So. Fantastic. Well, I definitely want to hear about where we're headed, but I also want to hear about where we came from. And as I kind of started before, I'm just going to remind everyone, this is our new Wichita Talk series where we're Wichita talking to the local people of the local places that you guys know and love. Certainly at the end of this, come on out to Tanganyika. And interact with some animals. But I'm going to turn it over to you. I might ask some questions as we go along, but if you could just kind of tell us about the history of Tanganyika.
The origin. So, we've been out here for, 1985 was our first barn, so almost 40 years now.
Wow.
And I think most people don't necessarily realize that.
Right.
Of course, back then, 183rd Street, most of the roads around us were all still dirt. The closest thing to us was Rest Haven Mortuary, like in Wichita, 119th
yeah,
Street.
There
was no houses between there and here on Maple or anywhere else. So we were definitely outside of Wichita, whereas now Goddard and Wichita touch. So we're definitely on that west edge. But, there was nothing much out here but some wheat fields. I think there was four houses on 183rd Street at that time. And now, there's 500 or 800 or some crazy thing. But I've been out here a long time. As far as the park and our family, the genesis of the park, though, really started with my dad, Jim. When he was young, his dad was stationed in the Navy and went through San Diego at some point and got him a San Diego Zoo guidebook. And he brought that back to my dad, Jim, and he just fell in love with animals, wore that guidebook out and just really had a passion for them even at that age. And so when he grew up, he wanted to become a zookeeper. That was his dream. Well, 1970s-ish, I don't remember the exact date, but the Sedgwick County Zoo opened in its current location.
Right.
We had the Riverside Zoo originally.
Right.
Which there's still some remnants there, and I think a few native species maybe at the Riverside Zoo. But they used to have some exotic stuff, but then decided to build the Sedgwick County Zoo. And well, when that zoo opened up, he'd go to the zoo all the time, to the point where the director came up to him one day and was like, "Kid, you're here more than most of my staff. Why don't you put an application in?" And so that's what he did. He was working on his biology degree at Wichita State, ended up not finishing that, but became a zookeeper, right? And
his dream.
Yeah, his dream. He was actually, I think, the eighth person that hired on at the zoo back in the day, you know.
And we're actually interviewing, little preface, we're interviewing the Sedgwick County Zoo in a couple weeks. So that'll be another episode awesome. Yeah, so here Scott, following this
Scott's
one.
And he's got a long history with the zoo.
Yeah, he does.
I don't think they worked together. I think my dad was done a little bit before Scott came on board. Jim Arlette, who was the former assistant director, him and Jim actually were hired on almost the exact same time.
Okay.
And worked together for a while.
Very
but,
cool.
But yeah, so now when he started though, the zoo, when it was first built, was just the farms. So, you know, and you'll get more of this, probably better history from Scott, but the American barn and the African barn, like that's what they started with.
Right.
And so when my dad hired on, he was taking care of these farm animals. I mean, he would milk cows in the morning and he stayed at the zoo overnight. He was like the overnight keeper and he milked cows early in the morning and took care of the chickens and the goats. I mean, he's essentially a glorified farmer, yeah. Right? Like in all reality.
You got to love animals to do that job.
Right. So, but he got to call himself a zookeeper sure. because those animals were at a zoo instead of on a farm. And, but as the zoo grew, so did his responsibility. He was one of the original keepers for Cinda and Stephanie, the two elephants that they got when they first came in, they were young.
Right.
Of course they only have one now, but, you know, they added the chimps and they added, so what was really cool when we were kind of putting together this origin story, we found, some clippings from when they first opened the African veldt. And I don't remember the year. And I think it might have still been the Wichita Eagle Beacon. It might not have just been the Eagle at the time.
Right.
And we found clippings of the new veldt opening. And on the there's a photo of the new boat ride or the boat ride that they have around the islands. And the there's a person in like the little striped shirt with a skipper hat on. It was my dad. It was actually the photo in the paper.
Awesome.
And then we found another photo of him from when he was there. And he's on one of the Monkey Islands. He's holding a monkey at the time. And, you know, the zookeeping outfits back in the day, they look like Ghostbusters. Like, they're like these jumpsuits, you know? And and so and he's got the big shaggy hair and the giant glasses from, like, the late 70s. So really, really iconic looks.
Can you send those pictures to me so I can post them?
Yeah. I'll try to dig them up. He'll hate every minute of that.
Fantastic. Is that who I met when I walked in?
That is,
I shook his hand.
You did.
Wow.
The man, the myth, the legend.
Wow.
So he was working at the zoo, starting to do more things. Well, his dream was always to, you know, kind of have his own collection of animals. So he started out with rare pheasants and doves because those were
naturally
lots easier to get than penguins and rhinos.
Right. By the way, this reminds me a lot of the way that the Riverside Zoo became about, which we've done an episode on.
Mm-hmm.
And just I'm just prefacing with, for those that like this episode, I feel like it was a very similar kind of just a lot of birds.
Yeah. Well, and you know, honestly, that's the genesis, not even necessarily birds, but that's the genesis of a lot of the major zoos in the country. You know, Nashville's a great example where most of that zoo was a private collection from a person that had their own facility.
Right.
And they partnered with the government. They built them a new facility in Nashville. And then he just moved the whole collection there and it kind of became their zoo.
Interesting.
And so it's actually the genesis for a lot of these major zoos that you see today. But I mean, most people don't necessarily realize that. So anyway, so he's after working at the zoo about 5 years, he decides he wanted to do bird breeding full time. He leaves. But shortly after leaving, a friend told him about an opportunity in South America where they needed someone to take care of animals that were being imported into the United States.
Okay.
So, you know, at this point, he's what, late 20s, doesn't know a lick of Spanish, going to head to South America. Like, what could go wrong here, right?
Nothing.
And actually, it was a really great experience for him. He learned a lot about the quarantine process. He learned a lot about the import process. He was able to get sources for rare birds in South America now and expand his network beyond North America. So it was a really great opportunity. After doing that for about 2 years, he decided he wanted to import birds from Africa. So he left. He went to Africa. The first place, you know, this predates the internet, 24-hour news cycle, all those things. So the first place he lands in the middle of a civil war.
Okay.
Not ideal.
No.
he was able to get out and finds a new location, picks a different country, gets there. Now, it wasn't a civil war, but it was a very economically depressed country. And, you know, he remembered hearing on the radio the president, and that is air quotes for people listening, saying, "I can't make everyone rich, but I can make everyone poor." So it was very, very socialist style. If you had more than four cans of food, you were hoarding, like right. those kinds of things. And so that caused some problems for him because here he was trying to export birds essentially for a profit.
Right.
And what he found out when he got there was that the export of birds was banned. So convincing them to allow it for a profit was kind of hard.
Right.
And that it had been banned for so long that when he went to find people to help him catch these birds, nobody knew how to do it anymore. Well, very few people.
Right.
So what he had to do is he had to convince, like recruit these elders from these different tribes to help him train some younger individuals on how to catch these birds. Got that done, check. And then he had to convince the ministers to allow him to export, even though it was for economic gain. Got that done, check. And then finally, figure out how to get him from Africa to the United States because you couldn't just Amazon Prime things back then, right? So there was no FedEx, no DHL. So long story short, it took him about 2 years to get his first shipment of birds in the United States.
And this is just for him personally?
Yeah, yeah.
To then breed?
Well, I mean, ultimately for zoos.
For zoos, okay.
Yeah. And so at this point, he was taking orders from zoos and they were trying to get – like he was the first person to ever import shoebill storks into the United States. And so, you know, some of these species like that, like he was the first one to be able to get these introduced into managed care so that we could start to also expose people to them, learn about them, and help with their breeding. And so anyway, he did that. With that first shipment, he started getting more orders from zoos. So him and my mom, they bought the USDA quarantine facility in L.A., moved to California. We lived in Escondido, so really close to the wild animal, San Diego's wild animal park.
Okay, and you're around at this time?
Yes, I am just two at this time.
Okay.
So we moved to California, and you know, at this point, my dad's gone maybe 300 days of the year, just around the world, all over the world, importing birds for zoos. My mom's at home taking care of 100,000 birds in this quarantine facility. She's also taking care of an incredibly cute two-year-old little boy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, her commute to work, since we lived in Escondido, it was a 100-mile drive.
Wow.
So from here to Salina every day.
Wow.
And if she didn't leave at 2 in the morning, it's a 5-hour commute instead of a 2-hour commute, right?
Right.
So she was a superhero, right? And
yeah.
She's managing this wholesale bird store as well. So things are going great. Jim is like the go-to person for birds in the country. You name a big zoo, San Diego, the Bronx, Cincinnati, whoever, they're all buying birds from Jim. And it's going well. Well, he had a client that had been buying birds, and Jim had shared with him his dream of building this world-class breeding facility in the United States, right? So instead of continuing to try to import them and everything, like, let's just breed them here, way easier. We're not pulling them out of the wild, whatever else. So he has his dream, tells the guy he's a very wealthy individual. He's like, you know what, I'll finance it, you put it together. So he spends a year putting together this incredible collection of birds, gets it done. The guy's like, all right, now I'm taking it.
Oh no.
Took this incredible collection, then through a series of other things, accused them of stealing, all this stuff. So long story, my parents lost the quarantine facility, they lost their bird store.
Oh no.
They ultimately filed bankruptcy and lost everything. My mom had to move home now with me and my sister, and my dad came a year later in a U-Haul because he didn't have a car. The only things he had to move left from their apartment were a couple of trees, you know, that were a lot, you know, live trees, not fake trees. And he had about $1,000 cash. That's what he was left with. So he didn't have he didn't have a lot of money or resources, but he did have a worldwide network of contacts.
Sure.
And my mom's parents gifted him 5 acres of land out here in Goddard. They borrowed money to build their first barn in 1985, and that established what would become the home of Tanganyika Wildlife Park. So here he is, you know, he has these contacts, and what ends up happening is he becomes his matchmaker for zoos. So like if San Diego has surplus gazelles, he'll find homes for them at other zoos, and in that process, maybe they had 7, he can sell 5 of them and keep 2.
Okay.
And that allows him to start rebuilding his collection back Because again, his dream was to build this world-class breeding facility for rare and endangered species. And so that allows him to start rebuilding his collection again. And so 1987, we built our second barn. It's a tiger barn where we actually have lions now. But
is it still called the tiger barn?
We actually call it – it was called the cat house for a long time. Yeah. Now we call it our tiger house. Now we call it the cat house because there's also our mer leopards and some other species. Right. Ironically, and we're actually working on this, but the tiger house is where the lions are, and the lion house we built is where the tigers are. Makes perfect sense.
Hey, you know.
Yeah. It's not confusing to anybody
not
new that
all.
Starts here.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So working on getting all that renamed. But so we built this, the tiger house. We got our first two tigers, a pure white female named Shubra, and an orange male named Benny, who is the last living mascot for the Cincinnati Bengals football team.
Very cool.
They would have babies, you know, a year later or something, and that would establish this as a breeding facility for rare and endangered species. So, you know, fast forward to 1990, we expand the barn, we add giraffe. We're one of the first private facilities to have giraffe. And, you know, just continue to add some different species as we grow. I think about 94, we have about 150 animals total, okay. Total animals. At this point, though, I mean, Jim was doing it, but he also was, you know, he had interest in, like, he started building homes and did some housing developments. We had a vitamin company from the, we had a big herd of elk. And so we would take the velvet, which has a lot of nutrients and things in it. We had a vitamin company from that.
Cool.
He was the president of the North American Elk Breeders Association and very involved in the elk industry for North America. So, you know, he's got a lot of different things, very entrepreneurial that he was doing. And so the animals kind of just became, you know, something we did, and we were working on these breeding programs, but not a big focus. Well, in 2000, we started doing these private tours in our backyard, because I mean they're essentially the whole park is and technically in Jim's backyard, right? So we start doing these private tours, and you know, it's seven species of animal they get to see, so not very big. It takes about an hour, but we have these school groups that are coming back year after year, right? And when they can choose between us and seeing seven species of animals or going to Sedgwick County Zoo and see 500 species,
right?
You know, why were they coming back to us? And what we found was that on that tour, it was guided, which was great for the teacher because then she didn't have to, like, corral the kids. So that was one benefit. But also, we did a tiger demo, and they got to feed the lemurs through the fence at that time. And we went out to a giraffe deck. We were one of the first places in the country to do giraffe feeding. We had a giraffe deck where they could feed the giraffe. And they, you know, the teachers could just see the impact that it was having on the kids, and so they were coming year after year. Well, by 2004... we're doing almost 5,000 people in this little backyard tour. We don't have sidewalks for half of it. We don't have a parking lot. Buses are doing like 20-point turnarounds. Like if you've seen that, if you've seen Austin Powers, that scene where he's got the golf cart and he's started, like, that's what it was like with these school buses. And then we didn't have public bathrooms. We had one bathroom in our bathroom kitchen, our barn kitchen for the keepers, which we only had three of at the time. And you know, you get a bus full of kindergartners,
right?
And the first 45 minutes is just them going to the bathroom,
right?
And so we just didn't have the amenities to accommodate that. And so at that time, we were like, you know, what should we do? And ultimately, you know, we didn't buy a zoo. We decided to build one.
Yeah.
And we built a zoo from the ground up. We decided to start, you know, laying out this new zoo. We started searching for financing. We secured the financing in 2006. We started construction, hoping to open in 2007. It was like one of the rainiest summers on record. And of course, when you're trying to do dirt work and utilities and everything else, it just slowed everything down. So
in 2007, you said one of the rainiest summers. That makes me think of Wild West World.
Yeah.
Because that was our first episode, because I worked at Wild West World that summer, and that was the problem. It was the rainiest summer.
And so the Dippin' Dots shed we have is from Wild West World.
Oh, there you go.
Bunch of brown trash cans you see around the park, Wild
West
World.
Fantastic.
So I'm pretty sure that his role in life, God's plan for him, was just to supply all the other attractions with really good stuff.
Right.
Like that's ultimately kind of what happened. It was a shame that whole thing happened.
Yeah.
That it didn't succeed.
Right.
You know, it would have been a great thing for the Wichita area. But anyway, so it delayed our opening a whole year.
Wow.
And so which was rough in terms of working capital and right. trying to find enough financing to now carry us an extra $1 million+ before we could get open and start generating some revenue.
And is this at this point, are we still on those 5 acres or is
no,
it grown
we,
at all?
This okay. is, yeah. So the park had expanded beyond the 5 acres. You know, we were up to, if you've been out to the park, the kangaroo barn.
Okay.
Where the kangaroos are, that barn has been there since, you know, 90s. Okay. Same with the goats and the alpacas, the llama. That building's been there since the 90s.
Got it.
So that was the end of, so everything, even some of that around there is new, but everything beyond that is 100% new since 2006.
Okay. And how many acres are we on?
Well, the park right now sits on about 25-ish. If you count the cheetah breeding area, we're at 39.
Okay.
Most people don't see that. I mean, you can see it, but you're not going over there. Right. The park has about 100 acres total. Okay. So we got a lot of room for growth.
Good.
In there. But so we decided to build the park. We officially opened August 2nd, 2008. We have 15 exhibits, I think 3 animal encounters at the time. So right. still not big. And, you know, over the course of the years, I mean, now we're at about 50 exhibits. We have 9 animal encounters and, of course, just a slew of animal experiences like behind the scenes and meet and greets and things that we can do. And so, you know, we're sitting about 500 animals in our collection. I think we're the 3rd largest zoo in Kansas. Rolling Hills is just a little bit larger than us. And, of course, Sedgwick County is way larger and will right. always be way larger. And so, you know, our collection's probably topped out. It's about where I think it needs to be. We'll be adding some new stuff with a future expansion of the Safari Park, but not a ton. So, you know, we're not looking to grow significantly more in terms of collection necessarily. Definitely wanting to add a lot of new experiences and stuff for people. But so, yeah, I mean, all of that just done through hard work, dedication, and my parents' passion to be stewards for animals, like here in managed care, but also in the wild.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. I felt like that was a lot, but
it was a lot, but it was a good of stuff. Absolutely. This is probably a stupid question. Do you have a favorite animal?
that's the $1 million question. It's like picking your favorite kid.
I right.
don't necessarily, but if I had to pick one, you know, we have a male lion named Nemean. So we got these guys 4 years ago, imported from South Africa. And Nemean is the last male in this incredible lineage in South Africa, this breeding facility. And he's just got this massive mane and just is a gorgeous animal. It's a bummer that he's off exhibit, like he's behind the scenes. You can actually go and feed him or the females on a behind-the-scenes tour. It's the origins tour. It's a lot of the story I just told you, but you get to walk through the original barn and you get to
cool.
feed the lions and do some really cool stuff. So you can see him, but part of our new safari park is to build them a much bigger new exhibit. So he's probably, if I had to pick an animal, would be my favorite. But, you know, favorite species, I don't necessarily have one. There's just sure. a lot of really cool ones.
Sure. In case you're curious, mine is the hippopotamus.
Ooh, like full size or like pygmy?
I mean, I prefer full size, but gotcha. I'll take a pygmy if gotcha. I can get my hands on one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just love a good old hippopotamus. Just they embody who I am so much. Big lazy animals that can be so aggressive need be. That's me.
That's right. On a dime, right?
On a dime.
Don't get on your bad side.
Exactly. We went to the Sedgwick County Zoo a couple weeks ago and I took a picture of the hippo, got a great shot, and I always joke, if you're a Harry Potter fan, that the hippopotamus is my Patronus charm. So I put like
that would be an awesome Patronus.
It was so great.
That would be really cool.
That'd be terrifying.
I like it.
Yeah. So anyway, where did the name Tanganyika come from?
Yeah, great question. So what's really cool about the name is when Jim first started going to Africa, he spent a lot of time in Tanzania, which, for those that don't know, like, there was a German territory, you know, 1940s, whatever, called the Tanganyika Territory. I actually have a map of it here in my office.
There it is.
And it merged with Zanzibar on the coast to make modern-day Tanzania. But most of that country was the Tanganyika Territory. It was a German territory. And that's actually where Jim spent a lot of time when he was first going to Africa to import birds. And so he just aptly named his company the Tanganyika Wildlife Company.
Okay.
And thought it was cool. What's really cool about the name, though, is we had no idea what it meant. It was just he liked the name. He named it. when we started doing tours in the backyard, so like this is like 2004, 2005, so been doing them a little while, someone from Africa came. Mm. And the name, the word itself is like a Bantu, like tribal language. So somewhat popular in the Zimbabwe, Botswana area. It was like the Zulu. It was in that area. So this tribal language, it's not like Swahili, one of the more common languages. Anyway, the name actually means the origin of life or the beginning of life.
Oh.
And so for Jim to have picked a name when his dream was to build this world-class breeding facility for rare and endangered species, and to pick a name that meant like the beginning of life, it was just like, whoa. Like
That's
it was
cool.
A definite God moment. And
that's cool.
When we first decided to open the park, like as a zoo, quote unquote, I'd asked a lot of different zoo directors and different people because I was new to that part of the industry, that side of it. Like, what would you do? What advice do you have? And one of the things they had said was you should change the name, right? Like, people can't say it. They can't spell it.
Right.
If you have a donor that wants to write you a check, they may not do it because they can't spell it and they're embarrassed and they don't want to ask. So then they're just not going to write the check. And or just, you know, it doesn't tell you where it's at. You know, we're not in Tanzania.
Right.
So, you know, they're like, you should be the Kansas Zoo or the Goddard Zoo or the, you know, whatever. But because it had so much meaning to who we are in our core, like I was like, no, it's, you know, I think it also is very symbolic of just who we are. We're a little gritty. You know, one of our core values is refuse to lose. And we don't just do something because that's what everybody else does. Right. We're willing to buck the trend. And I think when you look at the experiences and the interactions, and we really are trailblazing on a lot of those, pushing the limits to what people can safely do because we want to connect them with the natural world. And in the industry, there's a big divide on, like, a lot of zoos don't believe there should be any contact. Animal rights groups for sure don't believe there should be any contact.
Sure.
And you know, we know, and AZA has measured it, they've got studies that prove it, that the best way to connect people to the natural world and to have that emotional connection is through interactions, right? Ambassadoring an animal, touching an animal, feeding an animal, more so than just going and looking at an animal. And so, you know, so we're willing to try and find ways that we can experience them in new and unique ways so that people will care about them and care more about them. And so for us, it also is a little bit symbolic of that. Like, it's this weird, it's not a normal zoo. We don't call ourselves a zoo. It's not, you know, the Wichita, the DeSoto County Zoo, the Cincinnati Zoo. It's not. So I think it's also very much just kind of who we are. So that's kind of the name.
Cool. Very cool. Thank you for sharing that. One thing that I always take the position on these types of podcasts that I am the average Wichitan. I grew up here. You know, I've spent the majority of my life here. I was gone for a while, but I spent the majority of my life here. So if I don't know something, I'm guessing most Wichitans don't know that, or at least probably never heard of that. I did not realize until I was preparing for this podcast, and then you talked about it a little bit today, that you guys have the breeding component to the zoo. Can you touch a little more on what that is today?
Yeah. So, you know, that was Jim and Share, you know, that was their original, I would say the original mission of the park, and will always be an important part of like the legacy and what we do. But yeah, we have over, I think it's like 47 or 48 successful breeding programs for rare and endangered species. We've been incredibly successful at raising a lot of species that I would say zoos in the U.S. and sometimes even in the world have had trouble breeding. And so, like, if you look at clouded leopards, they are kind of the crown jewel for us. Our facility here, you know, our little privately owned, family owned facility in Goddard, Kansas, has increased the worldwide managed population of clouded leopards by over 20%.
Wow.
And so, you know, snow leopards, significant impact on snow leopards. Amur leopards for a long time were, no zoos in AZA were having success breeding them. And we were successfully breeding them, you know, every year. And so helping that species out because you need the diversified genetics. And so, you know, from a big cat standpoint or rare and endangered cat standpoint, I mean, we were breeding more than probably any other facility in the entire world in a given year. You know, we'd have 30, 35 babies from different species every year. So incredible success there. But even species like giraffe, right, we're more common in zoos. I think we're up to like 70 some babies.
Wow.
I think the only zoo to have more than us is like more baby giraffes born than us is Cheyenne Mountain Zoo in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
And they got like a 30-40 year head start on us, you know?
Right, so right.
We have two out there right now, and we're averaging about five a year. We're getting ready to split our herd for the new safari park, and so then we can increase our numbers a little bit, and, you know, we might even start having more than that. So, so we've been incredibly successful at a lot of those types of breeding programs. You know, the baby pygmy hippos, we've got those out here. I mean, if you love babies, you'll be hard-pressed to find a facility that you can come and see more babies at any given time, especially as a concentration, right? Like, I would bet Sedgwick County Zoo has a lot of babies every year too, but they also have 500 species or 400 species. So as a percentage, it may be a lower number.
Right.
Whereas for us, it's a very big part of what we do. And so as a percentage, it's a much higher number, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
it does. You know, I don't know that we have more babies than they do. They probably, I mean, with thousands of animals, they may actually still have more babies than we do. So, but one thing that's been unique about that or interesting about that is that over time, like, we'll have all these baby cats, and when zoos have, you know, like baby tigers or whatever, like, it's this big deal, and like, it's all over the media and all these people are going to the zoo. Like, we have never really experienced that. Like, it's the weirdest thing ever. Like, the Mer leopards, rarest big cat in the world. We had black Mer leopards born, right? There's like maybe a dozen in the entire world known in existence.
Wow.
And we've had eight of them born here. Like, eight of the 12, like, came from this facility. Right.
Right.
And
like, no one's ever come. I'm here.
Like, yeah,
I'm
like,
here talking about it.
No, nobody was like, "Whoa, we've got to go see that cat." Right. And we had this huge admission bump.
Right.
Like, for whatever, maybe we're just terrible at that part of marketing. I'm not really sure what it is, but we get some of the pressers out there, but like, we've never seen those admission bumps from that for some reason. But I know most big zoos do. They get that admission bump, and I've never quite figured that out. But interesting.
Well, I'm here reporting on the 8 of the 12.
Nice.
Yeah. You've talked about the safari park and some of the future of Tanganyika. Where are we headed?
Yeah, so I think you're going to see some big changes coming up just starting next year in terms of format and some of that kind of stuff. We're still working through details and what that's going to look like. So you may have to come back for part two.
I would love that.
Later this year, because we'll be launching a lot of that and want to tell a little bit more of that story. But as far as, you know, we're going to be launching a new capital campaign here pretty soon for a new animal experience center. So it's kind of the last phase of the Children's Zoo project, which, again, was not like a public thing. We had it in our mind.
Right.
The first phase of that was the penguin building and doing that. The second phase of that was the splash park, which we opened in 21. And then the last phase is to do this new animal experience center where... So if you've come to the park and you've done a behind the scenes or a meet and greet, especially, there's this little room. It's kind of a makeshift room. It looks okay, but it's not as big as we'd like it to be, especially for photos and things like that. And I don't know, the outside of it is ugly. I'm just going to say it. It looks ugly. It looks ugly. Like you're walking people to it and they're like, what are they taking us to, like a garage? Like, I don't get what's happening. Right. So, but not only that, like, we have animals that are like, the animals for those meet and greets are all over the park. Like, they are scattered in enclosures all over the park. So the Animal Experience Center, what it's going to do is consolidate them all into one room. And what it'll allow us to do is, our keepers spend so much time, and I'll say they waste so much time, taking these animals to and from their enclosures and like, having to get them ready and doing all this prep. Whereas now they'll be in the same building. So it's literally on a leash or whatever, walk them out of that pen, across the hallway, into the room.
Right.
And so we just saved 30 minutes, which now means that we can do that many more meet and greets with people.
Right.
Because especially in the summer, some of these things are just sold out and people don't get to do them. And when 60% of our attendance is coming from outside Wichita, you know, if you live in Wichita, you're a season pass holder, that's not a big deal. You'll come another day.
Right.
If you're coming from Florida or Colorado or wherever, that was your shot, right?
Right.
And so... now they miss out on that experience most likely. I mean, maybe they'll come back another day, but it's more of a commitment for them. So this will allow more people to get, you know, allow them to do a sloth experience or allow them to do a penguin meet and greet or some of these really cool experiences that we offer to people that you can't just do anywhere else or as much of it anywhere else. So the Animal Experience Center, with that, you'll see, you know, some new animals in there that we can ambassador. We want to add capybaras. We want to, you know, meerkat mining with the meerkats. I mean, there's some really cool stuff in that area that we want to add in that children's zoo area to kind of close it out. And then, you know, the next big project after that would be our new safari park that we're wanting to launch. And so, you know, that would take up about 40 acres, 40 to 50 acres. It would have a train, trackless train, though, and a drive-through truck, like you go on a truck, like you, almost like you would at Disney if you've been to Animal Kingdom.
Right.
Similar-ish experience. But we'd probably allow some feeding and some other stuff off of it. And then in my dream world, I don't know if I'll get to do it if we raise the money, but there actually would be a creek, a river through it where you could kayak the safari if you wanted. So like just like you're kayaking out on the Zambezi, you could kayak through the middle of the safari, you know, kind of a one-of-a-kind of experience.
Yeah.
It'd be pretty, pretty awesome. With that, you know, then new lion enclosures, some new small African stuff. You'd see mixed species out there with rhinos and giraffes and all kinds of different African hoofstock. There's a safari camp in the middle, recreating one of my parents' favorite camps in Africa. So these really high-end, they're tents. And again, air quotes, like high-end glamping,
right.
Really nice, where you'd stay overnight and the animals, you know, be around you. And
sounds awesome.
Yeah, it'd be amazing. On the north end of it, there's a new restaurant and some mixed retail there with potentially longer term, some Airbnb, like 1 and 2 bedroom type apartments that people could rent when they're coming. And then a new event center. So there's only, I think, there's less than a handful of facilities in the Wichita area that will accommodate 500 or more people. Mm. And so that's something that we would like, you know, for bigger corporations doing company picnics, bigger weddings, right. Conventions coming in, looking for offsite meetings, whatever it might be. Having a space that would overlook this amazing safari park and you could have a really cool event or, you know, wedding reception, whatever it might be, out there. And so new gift shop with that and some other things. So just a really awesome kind of chill area, new eating area where you could so we'd have multiple eating spaces in the park, kind of feed the new format that we're looking at kind of moving to. And so just would be a really cool, really cool space.
I love that. That's awesome. I went to prom here.
Did you?
Yeah.
With who was Garden Plain?
It was Garden Plain.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome. I think we've had a handful.
2010, I think.
We've had a handful of proms. Like not many because it, you know, most of the schools are a little bit too big to, yeah, to get all right, the kids there. But right, but yeah, we've done a few proms, yep, there. I probably chaperoned that. I was probably working that event that night.
Okay, so there you go. Yep. I was there. I was in my date was in a very interesting blue dress. I remember that. Haven't talked to her in many years. If you're listening, thanks for listening. We were at
I'm sorry for whatever I did. Right?
Oh no, I know what happened. Anyway, let's moving on. One interesting thing that you said during that little run right there was about 60% of your people are from not the Wichita area.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that you're bringing people to the Wichita area, obviously for the park, but then they're spreading, yeah, and
that's,
into the
that's
economy.
60% outside the state. I okay, forgot what the percentage is outside of the metro area, right? Like, okay, I mean, we're pulling people in from all over Kansas and then, wow, lots of states. So, you know, we've really grown to a regional attraction and our plan is to grow to a national attraction. And I think, you know, we're going to be will be a great complement to what the zoo's doing, right? Like the two of us together, I think can make Wichita a destination for animal lovers, right?
That's
and,
awesome.
And for local Wichitans, I think, you know, you don't always realize, like, when it's in your own backyard, you're kind of like, right, you know, I lately I've been calling it the Nazareth syndrome, you know, like people ran Jesus out of Nazareth, right?
Right.
Like, yeah, whatever, you know, like right, you grew up here, you were the kid, the carpenter, like, son, whatever, you're not nothing, you know?
Right.
So it's kind of, not that we're Jesus, but like, but like, you know, people and you're like, I think a lot of people, if you haven't been to other zoos around the country or the world, you don't realize how special the park is. And that, you know, I guess coming from me, maybe that's rich, but like the experiences we offer and the things that you can do with the park, and especially for the price,
right,
is pretty unheard of. And so, you know, I hope people will always and continue to appreciate that. I mean, I, you know, we donate stuff to all these charities around town, like Ultimate Weekends or Best Day Bundles, which is like unlimited feedings plus two of our experiences. And they'll bring 20% of what you would pay for them, right? Like, yeah, people just don't, I think, know or understand, maybe appreciate, because it's here in our backyard.
Right. Take it for granted.
Yeah, a little bit. And that's just, I think that's any, any place, yep. you know, you go in your city, like, or you, it's like, oh, you go to someone's pool and you love pools and you use pools all the time. And then you put a pool in your backyard and you rarely use it. Right. Like our pool table or,
right.
I mean, pick it. It doesn't matter. It's just kind of a human thing. And so, but yeah, I hope that people, will come to, if they don't already, understand and take pride in the fact that we have two incredible animal facilities. They're very different. They offer unique experiences, unique animals. And, you know, as a Wichitan, I can take pride on that. Like, honestly, we should be, and I think will be, on the level of a San Diego Wild Animal Park, right? Like, we'll never have their budget. But I'm just sure. saying, like, when you think of, like, for an animal lover and that to-do list, that bucket list, there's San Diego mm-hmm. Zoo and the Wild Animal Park. There's SeaWorld and Discovery Cove. There's, you know, whatever it is. And there's Sedgwick County Zoo and Tanganyika Wildlife Park in Wichita, Kansas, right? Like,
yeah.
If you consider yourself an animal lover, not the casual, I'm going to go, like, I want something for my kids to do. And we like animals. We, you know, maybe, quote, love animals, but it's more of that kind of casual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, this is like for people that, you know, are looking for those experiences or that destination kind of thing.
Right. I got goosebumps while you were talking about that.
Good, good.
Yeah, that's very cool. I was going to ask you a question, but then I started getting goosebumps. Oh, obviously, if people want to support this park, they can come visit.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else that people can do to help support, get involved?
You know, so we talk about a conservation funnel that, you know, our goal, like when someone comes out to the park, obviously we want them to be entertained and educated through the experiences and they connect. Our team spends a lot of time while you're here, hopefully. And then when we have a ton of people, it's hard. So on a slower day or that kind of stuff, you can be more impactful. But, you know, trying to get them to work down to care more, but also take more action. So there's a lot of things, you know, people, there's a web browser called Ecosia. It's like Ecosia, I think. And if you use it instead of like Chrome, for instance, they plant trees.
Mm.
I don't 100% know exactly how it works.
Right. It's I just good. Know
if you're using it for search and all that stuff, their mission is to help plant trees and it'll show you how many trees you've helped plant and
okay.
some cool stuff like that, right? Like finding sustainably sourced, like for seafood, right? Like, I mean, there's just different things like that where people get involved, that we try to give people action steps when they're here at the park. But, you know, I think just coming out to the park and supporting us, like, you know, it's a twofer, right? Like, not only are you getting an awesome experience, hopefully connecting deeper with nature, but you're helping us to sustain those animals, supporting the successful breeding programs we have, and that kind of thing, right? So you get some entertainment, some education out of it, but also are helping to make a difference just by visiting. So, you know, just coming out and visiting, doing experiences behind the scenes, if you've never done one, you know, do that. Like, season passes, our basics sold out this year, which was crazy. I didn't ever think that would happen. But we still have silver passes, which those are the passes that come with feedings.
Okay.
So there's still a great value. There's some enhanced value beyond that you get. They are, you know, they're like $100 a person. But you know, with that, you get 5 feedings every time you come and there's some other perks, but that, you know, that money again really helps us out and,
sure.
you know, come play in the splash park for a few hours, feed one animal and go home. Right. And, you know, if you got young kids, that may be all that you get.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of people are spending the whole day at the park now, but if you're, you know, for a local person that silver pass, especially cause they can feed one animal and you don't have to feel bad. Like I spent $15 getting them a wristband or whatever it is, 10 or $15. And they only fed one animal because right. that day they were being a little difficult.
Right.
Because younger kids can be.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to feel bad about it because, you know, they love lemurs and they fed the lemur that day. And we went to the splash park for an hour and that was a good day. Right. Like,
yeah.
And so, you know, silver passes are a great value. They're still available. And there's only, I think, I don't know how many we've sold, but we do have a limited number of those as well. So for a local person, I honestly think the silver pass is the gold pass is the best value. It is almost sold out if it's not. But silver pass is definitely the next best value for a local person and, you know, a great way to help us out.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to share today?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I appreciate the opportunity. Obviously, you know, very, very passionate about the park and yeah. what we do. And, you know, I think it's important just from the standpoint of, I don't know, the way culture is going and, you know, getting people and kids off their screens, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, that's, we had a session with a marketing firm yesterday and they're like, you know, who are you competing against? And it's, you know, we're not competing against Sedgwick County Zoo and Exploration Place and the, you know, Museum of World Treasures. We're competing against the iPad and yeah. the Android tablet and Netflix. Like, and for parents, you know, that's where the real battle is, right? And
right.
Is what can we do to get kids out? And I think as humans, because of technology and the way things are, like in a lot of ways, we're starving for that connection just with each other, right? Like, I don't know about you, but like, I'm probably not the best at like making sure I'm hanging out with my neighbors and right. knowing them or taking the time to just connect with people. But more so than that, like we also need to stay connected to the natural world. And what's amazing, and I've seen it, like, so for me, my part of the story, I guess, this is completely out of order. I probably should have said it earlier.
That's all right. I can always slip it in or just we'll leave it where it is.
The beauty of editing. So is, you know, so for me growing up with the animals, you know, it was no big deal to have tigers in my backyard and giraffes, right?
Right.
Like
yeah.
who doesn't? But I took the animals for granted because they were a chore to me. Like on the weekends when I wasn't at school, whatever, I was taking care of animals, right?
Right.
And so I want to go hang out with my friends, but the stupid zebra knocked the water off the wall and I'm stuck fixing that, right? And not bitter about that still. But like, but you know, and it just happened to be like, there's no different than a lot of farm kids in all reality. It's just that my horses had stripes and whatnot. So,
right.
My cows had really long necks.
Right.
So, I took them for granted, and it honestly wasn't until I got the opportunity to start my own business when we decided to open as a wildlife park and open to the public more. So I loved that opportunity initially, but it was when we opened, and after being open for a couple of seasons, to see the power that the animals have, like the connections with people had, it was crazy. And so for me, like that's what gets me up and out of bed. Like the breeding is an important part of our legacy. It was definitely my parents' dream and something we'll always continue to carry on. But for me, and you know, that generational transfer of the park, you'll see our focus now is creating these wow moments for people, right? We call wow moments, but it's that moment where they're interacting with an animal. And sometimes it's as simple as interacting with a giraffe or, you know, being on the lemur island and having the lemur on your lap, right? Even though as the attendant, I've said the spiel 1,000 times and you're the 800th person that's been on the island that day, you never know. Like I remember early on, we had this, you know, kind of the early part of Facebook, right? So I didn't have the wherewithal to save it at the time.
Right.
But a guy had gone on our Facebook page and shared this, not a story because they didn't have stories back then, but he posted on our webpage about how he was going to commit suicide. And he came to the park and he was on Lemur Island, and just that interaction with the lemurs clicked something in him, right?
Wow.
And it changed his life. And so he's sharing the story and how like he's doing better, and like he decided he wanted to live at that moment, right?
Wow.
Now, for the attendant, you didn't know that.
No.
And so there's these amazing wow moments that are happening all the time when people are connecting with these animals. And you know, that's just one of many examples. I could go for the next hour sharing stories of how these animals, you know, we have emotional support animals, and it's that on a bigger scale of how by connecting with the animals, you're connecting into something very primal within our human nature, right? Like connecting us back to the natural world. It's incredibly powerful, and I don't even know that it's measurable. And so, like it's that's what's happening, and that's what we're facilitating. And it's just, it's amazing to see. You know, last year we did 487,000 wow moments. Like the average zoo, based on a big industry survey that happened this last year, the average zoo that did experiences or interactions did about 30.
Let me add one to it. Wow.
So like that's what we're trying to do. I mean, our 10-year target is to have 1 million wow moments in a single year. Like, and so, you know, that's where we're headed. And, you know, it just, so I hope that people will come and experience that. And you know, I think our team deliver, we have an unforgettable guarantee. If you bring your kids out, especially on some of you do a lot of the experiences, the Best Day Bundle, you spend some money because I get it's not cheap.
Sure.
But you spend that money and we have a guarantee that if your kid ever forgets that they got to go feed that sloth, like you call us up, we'll give you your money back. Like anytime in their lifetime. I don't care if it's like they're now 16 years old and they're hormone crazed, digitally addicted teenagers. And you're like, remember that one time when we went and we fed that sloth at that zoo? And they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You called me up and you're going to get your money back, right? Like that's our unforgettable guarantee because those are the moments, those wow moments we're trying to create people. And so, you know, just come out, experience the animals, connect to nature and help us save species.
Well, thank you. Let's do it. Come on out. Hang out with some animals. Do you have a couple minutes to play our favorite game called 3M6?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. He looks at me like he has no idea what I'm talking about.
Nope.
He,
so it's gonna be, it's going to be good.
It's time for 3M6 on the Wichita Podcast. So for those listening for the first time and for you, 3M6 is our, on this show, it is our segment where we pick a random Wichita restaurant and we review it. We talk about what we like, maybe what we don't like. We give it a score out of 10, and we just have a good time talking about food. If you want to check out more about 3YUM6, you can go to our website, 3YUM6.com. You can check us out on all the social medias, 3YUM6. And you can find our blogs, our podcasts. There are videos. As you probably all know by now, the Pig Out Bros, myself and Big Klotz took down 8 patties from Ty's Diner, so go check that out. But yeah, 3M6, but we're going to talk about a random restaurant, so I'm going to ask you to give me a random number between, let's call it 3 and 32.
9.
Okay, number 9, let me see here, number 9, Sabor Latin Bar and Grill. Have you been there before?
Oh yeah, so that's some good food.
Well,
right
talk
there.
To me about it.
I mean, I really like the, you know, the Mediterranean cuisine in general, so like
my kind of man.
So you know, I think was there before Garth Brooks concert, so okay. And then you know, like it's nice, you know, whether it's a little fan, like I don't know, it is a little bit more upscale, which is kind of nice. So when you have people in town, it's a great place that you know, again, great food, a little upscale, so it's a nice, I think, and that's a nice area downtown right there where the old Warren used to be.
That was a nice place. Yes. Yeah.
So, but there's still some great restaurants and little shops down there. And so, yeah. And it's great for lunch too. I've had several, business meetings.
Okay.
You know, especially downtown being on the west side,
right.
Depending on where people are, downtown's kind of neutral territory there. Right. It's a nice middle place. And so that's a great, we've definitely done some lunches there that's been really good.
That's good to know. Cause I work right near there. Give me a score out of 10.
I'm always hard on 10s, right? Like, yeah. It's like to me, is 10 is 10 perfection? Or
10 is perfection. We've only had a few 10s. We also get pretty specific. I mean, we go some decimal points. So by all means.
I would give it a 9. Kay. Like, I think it's that good. Like, I mean, we don't eat there a lot. So I don't know if that's a measure of what a 9. But like, as far as, you know, if I had to pick top restaurants, I would definitely put it up there.
I like that score. I think that's a good score. If my wife was here reviewing it, and she'll probably be mad to hear that I reviewed it without her, she would give it a 10.
I mean, it's one of my wife's favorites, yeah, as well. Like, I think it'd beat her top 3, if not.
It's certainly, one, yeah, so. It's certainly my wife's top 3 right now, at least. She convinced me on a date night the other night to go there somehow. I was like, let's go somewhere new. And she's like, or we could go to Sabor. You know what she did? She did. Shout out my people over at Viva La Olive. Have you been over to the olive oil store that's down there in that same area? Viva La Olive. Those are my people down there. They have an olive oil and balsamic vinegar store.
Nice.
It's fantastic. I need to do a podcast with them. Note to self. Noted, they would love that. I'm all in. She's like, we could go by the olive oil store. And I was like,
You got suckered.
So we went to Sabor. And then as we were going to the olive oil store, you don't know this because you don't know me at all, but I have a TikTok/Instagram called Big Olive Dave where I review olives. So I'm a big olive guy. So I was like, yeah, I'm in. And so on the way out, she saw that little store down there that's I can't think of the name right now, but it's like the little boutique.
Lucinda's?
Yeah, Lucinda's. She's like, well, let's stop by there. I'm like, okay, that's fine. We need to get home soon to relieve our babysitter, but all right. And so we went in, and as we walked out, it was 6 o'clock and olive oil store closes at 6 o'clock. Oh, so I did not go to the olive oil store and I went to Sabor. No, but I like Sabor.
Bait
so
switch right there.
I know. She is good at that. No. The Sabor is good. I like Sabor a lot. I've gone there a handful of times with her. They have those plantain chips that are really good.
Yeah, we had those last time.
Uh-huh. And then with the chimichurri sauce and the queso. I told my wife, Emily, I would drink the queso. It was so good.
Yeah, we had that too, I think, the last time. And then I don't know. Like, I think I had a Cuban sandwich lunch. And it was so good. And then the plantain chips and, like, dip it in the queso or there was something else. Like, oh, it was solid.
Should we go there right now?
Yeah, I'm down, right?
Like, I really like their paella a lot. I have a great paella story for those. I'm not going to tell it now because it's nothing about Wichita. But please reach out. I'll tell you about it. And I got their shrimp tacos the other day, which were really, really good as well. And sangria and all that good stuff. So, anyway, Sabor. I'm going to go over the 9 hump. I'll give it a 9.37. 9.37. I think that's pretty accurate of what I think of Sabor. So go check it out. Well, thank you again for joining us. This was a blast. If you guys are looking for us on all the socials, Wichita Podcast, easy enough to find. You can email us at wichitapodcast@gmail.com. If you've got an idea for a Wichita series episode, please reach out via social, email, whatever it might be, and maybe we can get that going. Or if you work for an organization, you want to tell us about it, by all means, hit us up, Wichita Podcast. Obviously, tell your friends. We are streaming on all the podcast channels and all the things you can look for. Special thank you to Emily Hahn, technical director and singer-songwriter, mother of three, and the apple of my eye for being all that she is. She wrote our theme song that you're hearing right now. So thank you guys. Come on out to Tanganyika. I got it down now, and we will Wichita talk to you later.